The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
CBS, I Am the World. I'm John Batchelor, welcoming Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. The law that pertains now is the First Amendment, freedom of speech, the First Amendment, freedom of assembly. After a week of disorder on major college campuses continuing. Professor, a very good evening to you. You've written in defining ideas, your thoughts about the limits of freedom of speech and when speech is used as an explanation for misconduct. I quote from the president's remarks following some of the bad nights. Maybe they're more ahead, unknown. Destroying property, said Mr. Biden, is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not peaceful protest. I believe that it is very easy to agree with everything the president said there. And yet, during the course of these last days, I've reported repeatedly how the college and university administrators are keen on speaking of freedom of speech at the same time when common sense tells you freedom of speech does not explain the vandalism the president just illustrated. What is the freedom of speech that pertains, and how is it being either used or abused on college campuses today, Professor? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Look, this is a very tricky subject, and I think the first thing one has to understand about the Constitution is it has two parts to it. One is the written text, which states the basic right, freedom of speech, but the unwritten part, which has to be implied in all cases, is the limitation on that particular right. So the way the law has always been organized is I happen to hit you, and it turns out that looks to be very bad, particularly if it's deliberate. And then you reply that I did it in self-defense, and then I could come back and say you used excessive force. So what the law does, it goes back and forth between the parties, and most of the hard work comes in trying to figure out what the exceptions are and how they themselves in turn are going to be limited. And so when you say that you are in favor of freedom of speech, you certainly do not mean that you are in favor of the use of threats of force in order to get you away from somebody else. These threats of force are speech. They can say, I hereby will kill you if it turns out you do not give me your wallet and your money. And everybody in their right mind will start to say the threat is not protected, because what it does is it violates the libertarian norms against force and fraud, which may not be the whole function of government, but which there's very few people who would deny. And so what's happening in this case is people are talking about the first half of the problem, but they're completely ignoring the second half of the problem, which is where all the action lies. And so if you start looking at the president's speech, the word that I think you really have to put some attention on is the word trespass. And it turns out that this word has a very clear and defined meaning. It means to enter into somebody's property and to choose to remain after you're asked to leave. And there is nothing about the First Amendment which outs the law of trespass on private property. It's much more difficult when you go on public property, like having the massive street demonstrations after George Floyd. But the rule there is it's not the private property of the trespassers. And so when you start to see somebody blocking trains and blocking airports and blocking roads and occupying stations and things like that, all of that stuff is absolutely outside the pale. Even though these people have a right to be there, it's only under a series of implied terms of what is and is not a good behavior. And those norms are also being ignored in this particular case. And so what then happens is you see the official reaction. And what is it that you do? What happens is most people in government position, this is now happening today at the University of Chicago, is they're saying, you know, we do have tents and encampments on the main campus, but they haven't killed anybody yet, so we're not going to do anything about it. But then the next question is going to come, if they need supplies and sanitation, are you going to let it go there, or are you going to try to shut them off? And it's just not clear. So my view has always been at the first sign of trouble, you have to have a very clear, unambiguous, and powerful response, which says anybody who trespasses on this property will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law and subject to university discipline. And then just to make sure that you want them to understand, you quite literally read the Riot Act and tell them, you are now required to leave these premises. If you stay after a certain deadline, you are going to be subject to criminal sanction. Some people will leave, others will double down. And the key thing to understand is if they double down, you have to call them on the block. And you have to do what Columbia did and to clear the entire place out. And in order to avoid real mayhem, you must always use overwhelming force. Otherwise, there's a real danger of scuffles and resistance that could lead to violence. And that's exactly what they did. So on this particular issue, I'm a libertarian. And as a libertarian, I take it extremely seriously when somebody uses force and the threat of force and various other tactics to limit the free speech rights of other individuals and to subject them to dangers in their daily lives. So the president, I think, was right. The question is just where would he begin the trigger? I begin it very early. Then there's the question, what about, can you say anything that you want? And there's a law of defamation, and the answer to that question is no. There are certain things that if you say are so hurtful, so destructive of various kinds of social relationships that they're harmful. Defamation is not a new tort. You could find it as early as Roman and medieval times. It's one of the really fertile areas of discussion. It's a rather complicated body of law if you try to put all the pieces together in one whole. But the one thing that is true is that outright statements of falsehood, including false charges of genocide or similar kinds of behaviors, are surely wrongful. In many cases, a lawsuit against it is not going to be appropriate. But if you know the conduct is like that, then it is appropriate for law firms, as they did in the cases of many students who did pro-Hamas statements of the sort, Israel is entirely responsible for the death of its own people. They fired the kid. And if the kids wanted to come back and sue to get their jobs back, then you could plead the defamation that they engaged in as a defense against any kind of lawsuit. So when you're doing this, is you need to have a comprehensive theory, which covers both cases of occupation, cases of speech, and you have to remember that trespass and defamation are not in opposition to one another. They're parallel wrongs. And anybody who starts to say that defamation is free speech doesn't understand the logic of the First
Amendment. Professor, I want to push on. You mentioned the Riot Act. There actually was a Riot Act.
1715,
Several hundred years ago, but I want to update it a little bit in observing what I saw on videos. I didn't stand by and watch on videos that the trespass, you say, was a riot. It was a riot from the first. The behavior of the crowd entirely resembled the sort of the tumult that the Riot Act was meant to prevent. That is not, however, something that was introduced to those of us on the outside as a riot. It was introduced as a protest movement. Now, it strikes me that that's when common sense breaks down. It was gang behavior.
And the president sanitized the speech when he called it a protest movement. I mean, I'm all in favor of allowing people to protest with signs and all sorts of other things, but there are rules of decorum. And the most important thing, if you really want to protest, and you want to take to the streets, you have to understand that there's massive inconvenience to other individuals and that you must get a permit of one kind or another before you act. These are called time, place, and manner restrictions, and they apply wholly without regard to the particular substantive cause that you have. And they have always been permissible under the First Amendment.
Now, I want to understand the right to assemble, the right to make dissenting speeches, freedom mm-hmm. of speech, the right to protest. That is not what it looked like when it came to the crisis moment of breaking into Hamilton Hall. It didn't look like a protest. It looked like a mob. It didn't look like speech. It looked like violence. And it certainly didn't look like assembly. It looked like they were sweeping everything around them and breaking into private property. Now, all of that was defended on the basis of it being dissent. And that is unusually contradictory from my point of view.
Well, John, look, a good bit of naive horse sense will take you a very long way. The problem about the First Amendment, like so many other things that we see, is it tends to get over-theorized by people in a kind of a weird way. And so, for example, one of the fashionable moves on the left about this is to say, if I am against your cause, I have engaged in verbal violence, and since I have engaged in verbal violence, they're entitled to use physical violence against you. And sort of all the left-wing movements tend to take that up, and they redefine violence in a way which is now content specific to what they do, rather than being a threat of force, regardless of the cause that you're trying to advance. And it's this new system of theorization of the amendment, which essentially destroys everything that we've cared about. One has to understand, when you're dealing with protest movements of like this sort, which are so vehemently anti-traditional American institutions in every way, shape, or form, what they're going to do is they're going to redefine the First Amendment from the inside out in an effort to make sure that whatever they do is privileged and whatever you do is damned. And so if you have the rule that every time I say that I think these protests are illegitimate, that I've engaged in violence and they're entitled to use force, it becomes crazy. The thing to understand about this is time, place, and manner restriction have no regard whatsoever to the message that's being conveyed. If the Israeli student decided to storm Hamilton Hall, you would treat them in exactly the same way. But that this is pointless where the asymmetry began. And all of this actually began on October 8th, with that famous statement that was made by the Harvest Palestinian movement, where they say, we hold the Israeli regime entirely responsible for the violence in Gaza, right? And everybody said, there, that's free speech. No, it is not. That's outright defamation. And it may well be you don't sue them in court, but you certainly take down the bulletin boards and you subject them to sanctions for sharing outright lies. And if you don't make the distinction between truth and false and argue that somehow the First Amendment protests deliberately false statements as it presents true statements, then in fact you've also gotten crazy, because everybody knows the difference between telling the truth and knowing a lie. There's surely lots of cases that are white lies and grays, but this was just outright. And so when the Harvard people sat down and said, well, we protect free speech, right? What they did is they licensed the incitement to riot. My view is you started right there, and that's where you should have stopped.
You're pointing to the administrators and the faculty, and therein is the puzzle. Richard, you and I are of an age, and therefore a 19-year-old is easy to forgive. God bless. However, the 49 and 59-year-old professor linking arms to protect vandalism, what is that, Professor, but lawlessness?
It's complete lawlessness. Look, I mean, I have to tell you, I live in these environments all the time. And in many cases, it turns out that people are of a more or less classical liberal or conservative persuasion. They're regarded as persona non grata. What has happened in these universities is that initially they were dominated by, I would say, centrists. And when I was growing up in the 60s, I would have said Stevenson Democrats were the kind of people who were at the moat of the Columbia College campus on which. And they were tolerant about people.
There were a few Eisenhower Republicans, Professor.
Oh, yes, so sure. But I'm talking about 75-30 or 75-25. But I mean, I'm just saying that. And, you know, I lived in that environment and I was prematurely conservative in my sort of libertarian sense, not a right-wing Goldwater Republican at the time, although he continues to look better with age as he managed to escape his few campaign mistakes. But today what's happened is you get chopping at the department, turning out people in these new majors, all of which essentially have grievances on their head, and then they're in charge of faculty governance and the appointments of new faculty members. And so you need one simple measure. Ask yourself where the political campaigns go in a situation. Put aside Trump, who's an interesting guy. If you went back to 2012 with Romney, Romney and so forth, these numbers are 98-2 in favor of the Democrats. No institution is going to be healthy at all if it has such an incredible skew in the organization.
Making excellent points. What is to be done? Is there room now for an investigation of the faculty conduct?
I certainly think in every new president who comes in has to really review their hiring practices. And some of these departments they have to put into receivership, literally take them over from the center and deny them the power of appointment. And when you start getting appointments of people who supported the Hamas movement in the way that we're talking about, at the center, you deny them tenure and you have an investigation to remove them earlier. This stuff is life and death. You cannot run a university campus in which it turns out that everybody is of one persuasion, and the persuasion that they have is the university of which they are a part stands for fundamentally illegitimate goals. When the folks at Hamilton Hall put the name of a child, Heinz Hall, on the building, this was not only an occupation, this was an insurrection, as it were, claiming that they can displace political authority one way or another. And just to kind of put it in perspective, nobody can defend what went on January 6th in terms of melees and stupidity. But this stuff is much more serious. And if that stuff's to be called an insurrection, then this has to be called an insurrection squared. This is a most vital issue for the integrity of a university.
We need to rush to immunity, Professor. We need to
That's the same problem. I'm happy to go. And we have to be tough on false speech and make sure that the university places for discourse, not for terror.
Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. We're off to the Supreme Court. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to The Wealth Break.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone. It's not just about saving, it's about investing. It's about navigating systems that weren't built for you, embracing your hustle, and relying on your community to create something bigger.
And that's exactly why we created The Wealth Break. We made something different, something more human. It's not just another financial podcast. It's a conversation about real life, real struggles, and real wins.
We're here to talk about the journey. You're hearing from people who've broken barriers, found creative ways to succeed, and learn to build wealth on their terms. Whether it's the first-time homeowner, a gig worker, or someone turning a side hustle into a six-figure business, we're bringing you their stories.
And we're not stopping at success stories. We're breaking down the realities, like what it means to take risk, how to navigate failure, and why resilience matters. Because wealth isn't about money. It's about creating a life where you can thrive and help others to do the same.
So if you're ready for a podcast as much as about people as it is about money, you're in the right place.
Listen to The Wealth Break podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.